Today is Thursday. It's November 21st, 2019. It's 11:10 in the morning. And hi, this is John Williams. We're the Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio in beautiful downtown gray and foggy Chicago.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute and co-author of The New Chicago Way.
Justin Kaufman, the host of Extension 720 nights here on WGN.
Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter out every afternoon.
You guys, there's lots of local topics that to me are of all about the same weight. So let's just start with this one, which lit up my phones this week, and I knew it would. In Illinois, you are going to have to work, I thought it was 30 hours. You guys are telling me off the air maybe it's 20 hours a week to get food stamps, to be on the SNAP program, if you are an able-bodied
single
person with no dependents.
Right.
And under 50.
Yeah, under 50.
So there's that caveat. But it still carves out, I think, a lot of people that you and I sometimes see on the streets wondering, why aren't those people working? So there's two ways to look at this. This is smart. Our unemployment rate is under 4%. People need to be incentivized and stop taking the money. Or this is dumb. No one wants to be living on a couple hundred bucks a month for food. It will only drive people to crime or food banks and not jobs.
I think it's you need to be careful when you talk about welfare programs to talk about them as true poverty alleviation. People, the goal of the program should not be to increase dependency on the program. The goal of the program should be for the people who need it in the short term. They should take advantage of it and use it when they need it. But you need to free up space for people who really, really need that program. And in my view, it's totally reasonable to have work requirements for people who are childless, able-bodied people under the age of 50. And it's I believe, only in Cook County and in DuPage County
where the unemployment rate is.
And didn't this come from where there had been a waiver that allowed them to, and once the unemployment rate comes down, they could no longer get that federal or state waiver.
And this reform has been in place since the Clinton welfare reforms. I mean, this is a key part of that. And you see, there's a great study in 2010 from Northwestern and UC Davis, economists there. And they found food stamps actually do reduce hours worked and employment. It's not as severe as other welfare programs, but getting people off of that dependency when they're able to is a good thing.
But where do they go? I would just make the argument that says, okay, I'm going to force you to work 20 hours a week. Well, what are you talking about? Like, at Fry's, at McDonald's? Because a lot of these people are not going to have the resumes that are going to get them into a job that's going to be sustainable or interesting or anything that would be, that's a job. They're working for, for their food stamps. So I'm not sure where you're expecting people who may be at the lowest level of poverty to be finding 20 hours per week or whatever it is to work. That's the only problem I have is that perpetuating this idea that you have this, that people who are in poverty work at the lowest level getting minimum wage or whatever.
It perpetuates the idea that they're lazy, that's for sure.
Well, I think, too, that there is a feeling that post-recession we don't have a good handle. We as a country, as a city, as a state, have a good handle on what the unemployment numbers are. There are people who have just left the workforce, never to re-enter. And so I think getting a handle. So 50,000 people will be required under this.
In Cook County.
In Cook County alone will be required to find 20 hours of work each week. And I think because of the concern, we don't have a good handle on it. And we hear from various agencies, food pantries, that they are absolutely stressed, that's a better indicator of what the poverty level is, that this is going to stress them even more. And that really, this is not going to get at or help people, that perhaps better spending money on job training and getting people into
and they don't have to get a full-time, they don't have to serve fries, they can volunteer or they can do work training programs for the same number of hours. It's not like they have to convince someone to give them a job.
That volunteer thing is kind of interesting, right? Because maybe that'll eventually get them a job. I don't know if that's punitive, but there's something about the volunteer component that says, well, we're going to get our pound of flesh out of you. You're going to do something to earn that money that we're giving you. It's not true aid. It's an exchange is what it is.
Well, you're talking about habit forming, right? Like a job is much deeper than the paycheck. It's about serving other people, getting up at the same time every day, going to the thing, being responsible. And hopefully, those people aren't back on the streets. What the research shows is often they become job holding people because of the way that they're forced to at least be out in the world and be doing
really.
Something
so
like
you're
that.
Mr. Tough Love here. You liking this program?
I think it's a good step in the right direction, and a lot of other states already have this.
So. Where are you on this?
I think I'm with Austin. I mean, it 20 hours. If you it doesn't mean they're going to cut off the assistance. You'll get it if you work the 20 hours, and if you're able to work the 20 hours and the jobs are there, the volunteer opportunities are there. I do think it's a fair. I think it's a pound of flesh thing, but I think it's a fair exchange. If you're unable to work, that's another thing. But yeah. If you're able,
well, but then you wouldn't be in that 50,000 person pool if you're unable to work. If you have dependent children, if you have some sort of disability, there's a lot of caveats to carve people out. Still, 50,000 people are in that group. Anybody that comes downtown Chicago and has been panhandled makes the decision that the person who consistently works that corner could consistently be working someplace else. It doesn't bother me that some of my tax dollars are going to give people a couple $100 a month for food. I'm never exercised about it. People who get mad at other people when they are at a grocery store and they see somebody using a SNAP card and they're not buying nutritious food, damn it.
Well, that's, yeah.
I don't care.
That's paternalistic. Yeah, I think that's a different debate.
My only thing on it is just I don't understand extreme poverty. As a white male, don't recognize some of the things that are stacked against people in who are not white males in this society. So I find it hard to sit in the studio and be like, you know what? Yeah. They should work. They should get up in the morning. They should work. They should put their tie on and go to work. I don't know if it works that way. And I'm not sure at the end of the day that what able-bodied means and everything in between and why people are in those situations to begin with. So if I don't know if it's the government's job or somebody's job to tell those stories or to have a better understanding of the people who are in need, who need the aid that's coming from SNAP or from food stamps to let us understand the situations that these people are in. That's my only thing.
Anecdotally, I do work at I volunteer at a soup kitchen in Uptown, and I will tell you that we had some training and we got some tough love discussion, which was, listen, we're all a paycheck away from being in this position. So don't sit there and, you know, come at us with your New Yorker article and say, hey, you know, this is about somebody who has mental illness or something else. No, that a lot of these folks are left over from the days of the recession when they couldn't go back to work and they are stitching it together.
There's also something to be said about the fact that the unemployment rate in Cook County is 3.9%. I think that's the number. We're below the 4-point threshold. How good are those jobs? How consistent are those jobs? Is that truly an alternative for people so that they don't need a couple $100 a month and SNAP card, you know?
Again, if you get the job, you get the SNAP benefit. That's what we're talking about, right?
I mean, the nature of using the unemployment rate is an indicator of how liquid the job market, if there are jobs available or if they're not, you know, that it's less.
They're not saying if you're able-bodied, you don't get aid anymore. They're saying if you're able-bodied, part of the equation is you should volunteer, get training, or get a 20-hour-a-week job.
And again, it does go back to the 90s. These are Clinton-era rules. They're now adhering to them because the unemployment rate has dropped. And also, Trump is going to start tightening the rules on granting states these waivers. So it's almost like we're conditioning ourselves.
Yeah, get ready for this. Mm-hmm. Who knew? Many Illinois schools have detention rooms, small, isolated, often padded rooms to put students in who are so unmanageable they pose a harm to themselves or others. But the rooms are being used punitively, and a Tribune ProPublica investigation revealed how badly some of the children are being treated there. You know, I often say on the radio, guys, I think I've said it here too, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. Right. Support journalism is the point, because without the dogged reporters and time and resources of those two organizations, we wouldn't know any of this. Austin, you flagged this for me. We've all seen the story. What jumps out at you in the reporting on this?
I mean, it was a really affecting story, and so many people were sharing it. At the end of the day, it's thousands and thousands of instances of these rooms being used outside of their core purpose, which is for safety. They're not meant to change behavior. They're not meant to be punitive. They're meant to be used only in cases where a student is posing serious harm to himself or others or herself. So, I mean, you would have these quotes from kids in there, you know, talking about how they wanted to get let out, how they're going to die in there, really emotional stuff. But I think we talked a little bit about this yesterday. When you show that to teachers, you can get a bit of a different reaction to how those things are used. And I think that's important to recognize, too, because what I worry about with stories like these And this is not to say what my opinion on the solitary confinement is. I think I'm generally very opposed to that in schools. The problem is when you get a story like this and there's knee-jerk policy reactions, you might make things worse. And one of the things I heard yesterday was essentially you have to have a staff member in the room now with the student. And if the student is really being violent or really having a really tough time and being a threat to teachers, I don't know if that's in the best interest of the safety of teachers to force them to do that.
These stories are always great. I know this isn't, we won't talk about the substance of it, but I thought that the way that the Tribune and ProPublica did the story and the read of it, I thought it was amazing on their website. There had video that was popping up, and it was really sort of a new day for the Chicago Tribune. That being said, I agree with Austin that there's always two sides to the story, but ultimately, we never get this side. You know, we never get the side that from the kids. We'll get from the teachers. That stuff. Just the idea that I did not know that there were these rooms.
Some of the parents didn't know that they're kids.
And that's what great reporting is. I'm not saying I agree with Austin that I think the danger is the knee jerk, where now you're going to have the state of Illinois or others say or school districts that are like, no. But because it's probably more nuanced in the way it's being reported. But at the same time, it was not reported before, meaning we didn't know about what was happening, why those kids were in there, why being used for different reasons for what it was stated to be used for. That's what makes great reporting.
Do you think these rooms should be in these schools? My answer is yes, because many of them were designated for kids who were having some sort of learning disability. They have some sort of severe psychological problem.
Right. No question that they should exist in this day and age. But the question is that keeps hitting me is as awful as those kids' stories were of, you know, you're torturing me, you know, I'm going to die in here. I was struck by at least one story where there were several rooms and the bell hadn't even rung yet and they were full. And so
before
school even started. So what's going on there? And there were other stories about kids not getting angry and sort of knocking their books off the desk. All right.
One kid hung on the rim in the playground, hung on the rim, dunked the basketball, hanging on the rim. They say, no, hanging on the rim, you go into the detention room.
It becomes detention. I mean, or it becomes any sort of punitive or punishment. And I think that that's the issue that, yes, I think the schools need to have these rooms for serious situations, but it's been abused in the way that they're like, nah, just put them in the blue room.
But the key point is that's already against the law. That's the reporting is great because it revealed how the instances in which they were going against the law. So my knee-jerk reaction to the story is, how about we try enforcing the law
But here's what I think was missing in the reporting. And Lisa, I know you have something to say, too. But I think, I'll bet you more often than not, those rooms are used effectively. I wish they had talked more about the effect. Maybe it was only a story that was supposed to be about the abuse of these things. But I think these things are also being used appropriately a lot as well.
Why are we reporting if people are following the rules and doing what they should do? That's not a story. The story is when there's something amiss and that needs to be rooted out. You're causing undue trauma to kids, locking them in a room for an hour in a padded room by themselves. I mean, they're first graders, second graders. I'm actually a little bit more concerned about the younger kids. I should probably have more sympathy for the older ones, too, because, you know, there's something going on there, you know, psychologically. If it's a case of them wanting to harm themselves or others, but I'm talking about kids who might be talking in class. They knock a book off.
Yeah.
You could say it.
The Kaufman rule.
Yeah, right.
It was that kid knocking books off.
But I think kids are more violent. Teachers will also tell you, won't they, that classrooms are not more dangerous places, maybe, but there's just a lot more going on in classrooms these days. There is a lot more aberrant or violent behavior, just a lot of more busy behavior. Their cell phones are just, it's such a more complicated environment than it used to be. And I think teachers are at their wits' end sometimes in trying to control the room and educate the students.
This story, if we're going to pick a villain in the story, it's the administrators. It's their responsibility to train teachers to use them appropriately, to be compliant with the law, to say that why these things exist, they're not for behavior reasons whatsoever. That's who really needs to be trained or punished in some way, and probably not the teachers. Not to say there wasn't bad practices there, but I think it points squarely at administration.
What blew my mind about the story was that they were able to map that this does not happen in one location.
Yeah.
It happens throughout the state. And mainly, there was a lot about downstate, a lot of central Illinois. You automatically knee-jerk to the idea of it's going to be Chicago. It's going to be Chicago Public Schools. I don't even think they have those rules.
These are banned in Chicago.
That's not in here. And, you know, knowing just as someone who has a 12-year-old in the Chicago Public Schools, there are many times. My wife was a room parent and would be in the room where kids would snap, you know, at fourth grade, third grade, whatever. They'd have this almost yell of, and the teachers are so quick. Like, we were just saying that, like, they're in a new day and age where they're like, the minute anything goes wrong, they're out. They're in the principal's office. So my wife would come home and say, I didn't think that this person or this kid did anything wrong. But they're like, did you just look at me? Out. And so there is a new world order when it comes to that discipline. And maybe the teachers have learned, like you're talking about, like maybe they've been trained to say, don't take on that conflict, move it on the line to the principal or whatever it might be. But yeah, the idea that this is being used or abused in several different spots, I think it is more about the administrators or maybe even just the concept of discipline in schools, which somewhere along the line, someone trained it this way.
Well, a million years ago when I was in grade school, I can remember actually a few years ago, my retired school grade school principal saying everything has changed since you were a kid. It used to be an anomaly of parents. We couldn't get parents to sit down and talk to about their kid having problems. Now it's most of the parents. It's a battle. It's us versus them rather than all of us together. It was a Catholic grade school, so I suspect that some of that is part of the priest abuse stuff. We're not going to trust everybody in charge. But I do think that I've heard that from any number of people who've been longtime educators, that it's public schools, all schools. It's a different day.
Also reminds me of how much we ask schools to do. You know, a lot of kids are getting two meals a day there. They're being educated. They're being disciplined. They're dealing with all sorts of psychological things that nobody else seems to have the resources to handle.
That issue came up. We kind of dismissed it, but it was a big part of the teacher strike that was in Chicago. I mean, this idea of what is the role of teachers in 2019. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah. Right? The reporting on that's going to continue. It sounded like the State Board of Education didn't even realize this was going on or didn't seem to have a handle on it.
Yeah, the records kept weren't very good. Again, like enforcing the law. The law wasn't being enforced. You're supposed to document every instance of these and say a reason why, and that wasn't happening at all.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes the reason wasn't happening was because the teacher's like, I was pissed at this guy. I know it wasn't the law, but damn it, he knows he's going in the box.
Definitely.
And they put him in the box. A 14-year-old white Naperville High School student, 14-year-old white Naperville High School student, posted a slave for sale ad on Craigslist with a photo of a black classmate. The ad included a racial slur, was viewed, it was commented on, the boys being charged with hate crimes. The boy's defense attorney says that the two kids are friends and he's trying to coordinate an apology. I don't know what the student who was profiled in the ad or that kid's family thinks about all of this. State's attorney's trying to figure out how vigorously to prosecute this. It's been a bad month for Naperville in this arena. I don't know, guys. My gut reaction was terrible, terrible, terrible. I don't know if this is what we had in mind when we came up with the phrase hate crime.
Maybe we need to put this kid in the shoe.
Well, you know, I see similarities here to the case, some rough similarities, of the Lake County thugs, so the ones who came up from Chicago, and a Lake County resident shot and killed one of them while they were trying to rob his car, and they were charged with murder of their fellow thug's death. And those charges were later dismissed or dropped, diminished.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the sort of thing that we'll see here as well.
That they'll maybe say, okay, this is terrible. The kid's suspended for a couple of days. He might be suspended longer. But, right, maybe when everybody cools off, this won't be as... Is that what you're suggesting,
Steve? I'm wondering if prosecutors will ease off or there'll be some sort of an agreement. Yeah. Okay, well, but if you're 28, this is a hate crime, right?
To me, it just seemed like I wasn't there, right? But is it plausible that it was two knucklehead kids, they really are friends, and the one kid said, watch this?
Wouldn't that suss itself out in the police report? Wouldn't that suss itself out before they do charges? Isn't that police work where they sit down and they talk to the kids to the family?
But other people see it, and then there's outrage, and then there's public pressure. Right.
I think this is the life cycle of something like that. So first you say hate crime.
Yeah, they say hate crime, and then they let the state's attorney or whoever work it out after that.
The victim also, I assume, is 14 or 15, and what does that kid think, and what does justice look like for that kid? Does justice look like charging his classmate with a hate crime for that, or does it look like having some kind of other mediation or training? I don't know. I have a hard time thinking you know, that kid's young too, but I don't know if that kid would want his friend to be charged with hate crime.
Right. Yeah,
I don't
no kidding.
Know. And if he does, that's his right to as well. I would be curious about the victim's perspective.
I can't even get you're farther along than I am on this, because I can't help but wonder what that poor kid thinks. Sort of like, I can't, it's embarrassing.
The kid who's
ad Yeah, the victim here.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I would think it would be absolutely horrifying and embarrassing, and all these things.
Especially the comments. I mean, I didn't see them. I don't know that they shared them in the reporting on this, but they said there were comments and kids were chiming in, and that's the sort of piling on that must really be disturbing to the victim mm-hmm. in this case, and that kid's family. You guys, Kim Fox has an ad.
It's different now, but I grew up at Larrabee and Division, better known as Cabrini Green. It's where I learned to be tough, to survive, overcame poverty and sexual assault. State's attorney is a tough job. Every day my office is under attack from a president who uses our city as a punching bag, the NRA hell-bent on letting guns flood our streets, and the FOP clinging to the old ways. They'll do anything to undercut progress, including attacking me personally over the Jussie Smollett case.
She's running for re-election. Nobody's surprised about that, right?
No, not at all.
Have you guys seen that ad, the two-minute
yes.
version online?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
What's the reaction to the ad?
I've never seen a political ad where a politician says, and I'm sorry and I own that, on the Jussie Smollett stuff.
Over the Jussie Smollett case. Truth is, I didn't handle it well. I own that. I'm making changes in my office to make sure we do better. That's what reform is about.
I was just thinking of everyone who's run who's had scandal attached to them in any form. They find every which way to kind of work their way around it, to not mention
it. I think it was a lot more nuanced than that. I didn't see it as a full-on apology.
Has she explained what she did wrong and owned it? And we don't know what she owns.
No, I didn't handle it well. I own that. I don't know what that means.
Right. I think that's like, do you remember Rahm's ad where he's like, I know I can be a bit of a curmudgeon, but
yeah.
How about the woman running for Senate in Delaware? I'm not a witch. Right? Remember that?
Right,
about
right.
10 years ago or so?
Everything about it has just been convoluted on this Jussie Smollett story. The problem I have is that they have a special prosecutor who's going to play it out. And as someone who would like to be objective, I'd like to see what the special prosecutor says. I don't understand the concept of her going out in an ad and saying, I didn't handle it well. Because now I'm like, is that an admission of guilt? Is that an admission that there was some foul problem, that you did do something out of care? What are you talking about?
You know, it's also provocative about this is that she takes on the police department or the FOP.
Absolutely. Trump everybody. And
marries the two together, by the way. Keep
right,
going.
Right. She's trying to sort of, okay, we're going to put that on the shelf and we're going to talk about criminal justice reform. You know, and she has made some inroads there. I mean, you can't do this in 4 years, but she's definitely made some inroads there. But it's going to get clouded out with all of this Smollett stuff.
Tell me something good she's done.
I think that she has made sure that low-level offenders are not languishing behind bars. And I don't have the stats on that, but I know that there are questions, too, about gun offenders being let go, and that's a big too soon.
What about the marijuana?
The expungement.
The expungement of those.
Right, right.
You must be reading my community's Facebook page, because every time somebody gets, there's an article posted about someone who got mugged or anything like that, Kim Fox's name is a third one down saying, "Whoa, how's Kim Fox now?" And I'm like, there's a desire in this city to say anything that happens with crime, we need to attach it to the state's attorney. I'm not saying that's new. I mean, you know, I would say that's probably the same with Anita Alvarez, but I'm saying it's amazing to me that the issue of criminal justice reform, which is what she ran on and won wholeheartedly.
Well,
I mean, she drubbed.
Don't you think she won on Laquan McDonald?
She did, but that was a lot that had to do with the fact that people wanted something from their state's attorney that wasn't part of the machine, that wasn't covering up crime.
So you just picked Preckwinkle's chief of staff, that machine.
Right, 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 right.
But I think that she has been, I agree with Lisa that I have not had a problem with her trying to thin the ranks of low-level criminals at Cook County Jail. I think that there has been a movement to change the way we look at policing, or at least putting people in prison. And that is something that if you talk to some in the African-American community, that is the biggest issue in the city of Chicago. And I get the flash, the pushback, and but the FOP was not for Kim Fox to begin with. So let's not pretend that they don't have the, oh, now what's going to happen? The FOP's mad. They were mad when she ran and won the first time.
Yeah.
Jussie Smollett's the only thing in the middle, and which I think is hilarious, that the FOP are the ones that are connecting to somehow Jussie Smollett's their hero story, which is ridiculous because I don't think it makes anyone look good, including the police. So to me, it's like, I think that, you know, that special prosecution, or the special prosecutor in Dan Webb, that'll be a big part of what happens with the state's attorney race. But I don't see any viable
alternatives.
I mean, right now it's an FOP candidate. Yeah, I
don't know. This former assistant prosecutor, Bill Conway, his dad's got deep pockets, and he's already on TV. He did a digital ad that kind of pushed back at her policy, but on TV, he's talking about gun violence. He's not mentioning her. He's talking about serving over in Afghanistan. I believe he's a naval reservist, and how he was over in Afghanistan being fired on, how he thinks about that when he picks up the paper or watches TV, and he thinks about these kids having to live in those kinds of neighborhoods in that kind of violent situation, and how he wants to make sure gun offenders are in jail as long as they can be while they're awaiting trial. So that's a little bit of a dig at her.
I think the ad is a good ad.
Her new ad, it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, the visuals, the audio, she's a very good TV performer. Mm-hmm. It's a really good 2-minute commercial.
Cook County Democrats can fund some good ads, man.
I'm telling you.
But it's only online, right?
Right.
On
well, the 2-minute version. Slick. I'm sure we'll see a 29-second version of it on TV sometimes.
How do you gel the fact that she is the chief of staff of Tony Preckwinkle? She's the Tony Preckwinkle wanted her there, and the fact that she's a reform, that she has run a reform candidate, she ran for the first time, and the progressives love her. That's the issue, that because she's not Chicago way necessarily. Maybe she is in the back rooms, but she's definitely attracting a progressive, not unlike Lori Lightfoot, a progressive vote that's going to come out.
Well,
for
Lisa, answer
because for decades, Tony Preckwinkle had been painted, especially by the editorial boards, as this reformer. She painted herself as a reformer. People bought into it, not just the editorial boards. People bought into it. And we kind of learned in this mayoral race that you're in politics long enough, some of that reform, that well-defined reform edge is not really there. I just think it happens over time. I'm not saying that Tony Preckwinkle isn't a good, you know, public leader, elected leader. I just think that she also knows how to wheel and deal. You don't become president of the Cook County Board, you don't become head of the Cook County Democrats without wheeling and dealing.
And how the reformer image gets tarnished is exactly a case like a Smollett, where the politics angle does interfere with, and it will, and,
I guess,
and
she
has
could,
for all these
could
people.
She have ignored that in the ad, Austin? Could she have just said, hey,
I
listen.
Think so.
No.
I think she could have, yeah.
I don't have any issue whatsoever with her ignoring. If she ignored it, I'd be like, great.
Well, but
I don't care.
She couldn't ignore it in the campaign. I mean, it was going to come up.
There's a difference between the campaign and the ad.
But I'm assuming that she's hoping that she comes out, she owns it here, and it goes away.
Well, this
it's
is
the
her
launch.
Launch
of her campaign. She has to address it head on. I mean, I agree. I don't know about your community Facebook page, but I'll look at an article that her staff or she posts online on Twitter, and I'll call up the story, and then you'll see 20 comments, and they're all like, oh, Jussie Smollett. I mean, it's mean. It's not nice. I'm sorry I even brought it up, but it is. People are coming after her on it. She's got to address
linking
it.
Her handling of that to Smollett.
Yes,
And I don't know that that's going to go away, and maybe.
How does her ad, I don't think it abrogates that at all.
No.
And if anything, it incenses those people.
Well, maybe she'll run another 2-minute ad, or maybe over the course of the next 5 months. We're talking about March, right?
Even better, get Jussie Smollett to do an ad for her.
I was thinking that, an endorsement.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
He could sing. He's out of an acting job. Yeah.
He could sing. He could dance. He did a lot of things in the ad. He's a multi-tool actor.
Yeah. Who's he suing now?
The city of Chicago and the police.
Yeah.
For
malicious
prosecution. Which is, I think we could spend an hour on that. That's fascinating because he's essentially saying that they knew that there was trouble with the twin brothers' confession. That the police knew that there was a problem, and that they had already seen that it was cracking at the seams, and they're like, just like we were talking about with the new day and age, where they wanted to charge him and move it on to the Cook County State's Attorney because they didn't want to deal with it. So he's saying malicious prosecution on the police detectives because they knew that those brothers were lying, and they didn't do anything. They went ahead anyway.
I want to go to Trump land. Questions are being asked whose answers are generally known in the hearings, right?
Sure.
I don't mind that because I didn't read all the transcripts and I wasn't behind all the closed doors. So the notion that this seems scripted or that the Republican response seems dismissive isn't all that surprising or even upsetting to me. I'm learning some stuff. One thing that is hanging over this week to me and last week, too, is the Republican observation that the aid did go through to Ukraine, as though that means there is no quid pro quo. There was nothing illegal. There wasn't even anything unethical.
To me, this is, I still try to understand and scratch my head at the idea that what's really at the center of this is that the president asked a foreign entity to investigate his political rival and held up money to do so. That, I don't think anyone is really disputing that. At the end of the day, this is all about the intricacies and the here. I mean, on both sides of the aisle. I mean, they're really. I don't understand how we're just not back to that point, because that's, and maybe that's what this is. It's dressing for Democrats to say, okay, you're impeached, and move it to the Senate, because it does. I don't know if anything that's happening in front of the Intelligence Committee here is going to change a politician's mind in the House on how they're going to vote on impeachment.
Well, go ahead, Lisa.
No, I think what's not in dispute is that this phone call took place and that a favor was asked.
The original call, yeah.
The original call. I think that that's, to me, that's not in dispute. What's in dispute is then everything after, right? Oh, did you hold up the military aid? Is there proof that you held up military aid? And I think I covered courts too long, because I am waiting for that moment when somebody says, "There, you know, President Trump told me in this meeting..." I'm not saying that it didn't happen, but I'm waiting for that aha moment. He told me that we are not going to do this, and we're going to hold up the aid, and we're not going to have, there's going to be no meeting, and just sort of that very direct aha
That's
moment.
That's the core of the monotony this week that you're talking about. It's because none of the witnesses have direct knowledge of that.
But even
call.
If somebody said that, would everybody believe it?
I just wonder if you took that out. Let's take that out. Let's take out the fact that he didn't hold up money, right? That was just really just a coincidence. It still doesn't change the fact that the president asked the president of Ukraine to investigate his political rival. And now hearing Sondland say that it wasn't really about investigation, it was just about, can you say it? That is specifically about helping Trump, not helping the U.S. That is still in the realm of impeachment. Maybe you'll say, and you hear Republicans say, so what? No big deal. But it's still in the realm. So does that change your mind as a court's report? Do you stay?
No, it doesn't, because it's going to go to the Senate for a trial. If articles of impeachment are filed, it's going to go to the Senate for a trial. There will be a judge that they will sit and listen to this like a trial. And they will want, I don't disagree with Quigley, that sort of circumstantial evidence is you can see it all the time at 26th and Cal. It's used all the time. Use your head. This happened. You know, you can link things together. I'm not saying that. But I think that in this very public space, I think that there's going to be a call for some kind of aha moment, that I need direct evidence. You can't just sort of speculate. I'm not saying that it didn't happen, okay? I'm just saying that looking
but
at both sides.
Of this, I'm saying forget the money. It did happen. No one is saying it didn't happen. He did ask for a favor.
He asked for a favor
to say, investigate my political rival. And the only thing I'm saying is, at the core of the job, it's to represent the interests of the United States of America, not yourself.
Right.
So in this case, this is for himself.
Right. And their argument is that, oh, it's for diplomatic reasons, that we want to root out investigation or corruption in other countries.
This is where I think you could make a case, and I think they are making a strong case, that he's shown so much contradiction in that argument, the idea that he was rooting out corruption, then he doesn't do it here, and he doesn't, that I think a judge would say, no, you weren't trying to do corruption.
I think another interesting thing with the aha moment, though, is if they do go to the Senate and those people are called to testify, the leaker will be called. Sure. Yeah. And is that advantage to the Democrats or not?
The whistleblower.
I don't know if it is. And the polling has been interesting. Gallup just put out a poll, and it's basically the same impeach or not impeach that it was before the Politico report in September. It's flat. Trump has ticked back up again. So I think the longer this drags on in this fashion,
politically. I wrote a little bit about yesterday, and then a president, and so did everybody else, the president is citing that people are moving away from wanting impeachment in Wisconsin.
Well, the president said there was no quid pro quo. pro quo, and the president of Ukraine said that he didn't feel pressured, and the money eventually got passed through. The aid went through. And those are sort of the three points that the Republicans keep hammering away. And, you know, my response to the walls when I'm watching this in my office or at my house is, if you're getting hit with a stick, and I say, are you getting hit with a stick? And you say, no, I'm not getting hit with a stick. You're still getting hit with a stick. You know, what they say is one thing, but what the evidence produces is another. Right. And I don't know how compelling those two statements are by the presidents if, in fact, the evidence points to something that sure looks like the opposite of that.
And it's hard to do because we have just wrapped ourselves so tight in our identities as political, meaning you're either Republican or Democrat, you're left, you're right, whatever it might be. But it's now more probably than ever, and even though this is not new, meaning this country has done this for 200 years, but the concept being that I'm not sure any evidence is going to change a Republican from voting against their Republican president, and I don't think that it's going to change any Democrat who says that I'm sick and tired. And it's really not about whether or not the quid pro quo and this, that, and the other. And I know that's the specifics of what we want to talk about, but Democrats feel this is just another situation in which the president has abused his power as president of the United States. And so the idea, this could be Mueller, this could be this Comey. Right. It has been a consistent. I know people want the argument will be you're trying to redo the election in 2016. I don't agree with that. I think that it's just been a pattern of watching this president essentially say to, you know, sort of flip the bird to the Constitution over and over and over. Now, maybe Republicans like that. Maybe there's an issue with that, but there is something to be said down the middle. You know, you're not supposed to do that.
We have to wrap this up. Will you be sorry or glad or neutral if the whistleblower is called to testify?
I don't have a problem.
You're okay
I think
with
the
that?
Whistleblower
Where are you on that?
I'm in the middle.
Really? What about you?
I'm in the middle.
I will be sad. It seems to me like the very purpose. Steve just strolled back into the studio. You want to chime in on that one, Steve
Bertrand?
I think
I'm surprised by your answers. I think it would be a terrible thing if a whistleblower was compelled to reveal him or
too.
Herself.
If it's a person who's been resistant to it, if they volunteer, that's one thing.
But especially when the
that's what I'm waiting for. When it gets to it, things change. The tectonic plates shift as this thing moves forward. So I'd like to see what that person wants to do.
If they want to do it, I'm okay.
Yeah, but there's a long history in the United States of America of whistleblowers coming forward to call out government officials, and they have ultimately revealed who they are. There's not a lot of situations.
The individual is outed themselves.
Like, I mean,
that's okay.
Yeah. So to me, or not just out, meaning through the process of doing so. So I'm not sure that at the end of the day, there's precedent for this person to stay anonymous, especially if you get to the Senate and you're doing a trial on the impeachment of the president. And at this point, I'm a little bit like, they're all whistleblowers. Everybody who's been in front of people are on a White House call to Ukraine.
And it's not, they're not prosecuting the whistleblower. It's being called the it's a little bit different. And I would be, if that person were prosecuted, that would be a different story.
Right.
We're out of time. Thank you, Austin Berg. Thank you, Justin Kaufman. Thank you, Lisa Donovan. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.